Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. This evening we're going to have Dan Brady on with us, and he's going to be talking about his book, The Iron Triangle. And it's the inside story of the Carlyle Corporation, really one of the most fascinating parts of this whole elite structure that rules the world. And we're going to be talking about that from his point of view. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls because maybe until about half hour. And then, of course, call in if you'd like at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, it must have been, 6 or 8 years ago when a friend of mine in the East called me and said, you've got to look at the Carlyle Corporation. Carlyle Corporation is Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of Defense, James Baker III, former Secretary of the State under George Herbert Walker Bush. And, of course, they are in Carlyle Corporation, and Carlyle has just brought the Bradley fighting vehicle and the rights to the mobile howitzer. Obviously, they know we're going into a war, and we're going into a desert war, because that's, of course, where something like the Bradley fighting vehicle would be so vitally important. Well, at the time, I thought that that was, well, I mean, that was the time we were at peace. Eight or nine years ago, the Berlin Wall had come down. Everything looked great. The era of war was over. America had won the Cold War. At least that's what we were being told. We were the lone superpower. The idea of another war at that time. But then I always figured that the people who, of course, make the rules are a lot smarter than I am. And what did they know at that time that the average American didn't know? Well, since then, of course, we've seen some very, very powerful people associated with Carlyle Group. It is certainly one of the most powerful corporations in the world. And so I'm going to let Dan tell us a lot more about Carlyle, because he has researched this, and, of course, the only person who would talk to him was the co-founder of the organization, who was pushed out of it. And so he at least got some insight into this and how a tax scam for the Eskimos led to this multi-billion dollar corporation that now has something like $16 billion. It's a holding company. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? I know you're writing another book on other major corporations. Tell people who you are, how you got interested in Carlyle, and then, of course, we'll get to some of the more interesting facts about this corporation that's above government, above everybody, a power structure unto itself.
Sure. Well, I am an investigative journalist and have been performing that role for better part of past 10 years. And as such, you know, it has been my job to look into various companies. And in the wake of the September 11th attacks, I was working for a magazine called Red Herring, and we wanted to look at companies that stood to profit from the war on terrorism. And one of the companies that we identified was the Carlyle Group.
Of course, that's because was that in part because of the Bin Laden family had such a large investment in it till the time of 9/11?
That's right. One of the ironies that came out about this group after 9/11 was the fact that the Bin Laden family was invested in one of their defense funds. The Carlyle Group, as you know, is heavily invested in defense and aerospace, and one of their marquee defense funds was a fund called Carlyle Partners II, which was something that the Bin Laden family had a substantial sum of money parked in it. And the irony that came out of that whole situation was the fact that the Bin Laden family stood to gain financially on the war that was at that time being waged against Osama Bin Laden, their own brother. So we thought that was a pretty interesting element. I started looking further into this company and just discovered an amazing array of powerful political maneuvering, global politics and global business, and some very disturbing conflicts of interest, particularly regarding the role of George Bush Sr. Advising on foreign policy while his son is in office.
Well, did you ever know an investigative reporter named Jim Keith? Do you know who he is?
I don't.
All right. Well, Jim had an opportunity to interview a few times. He's written a number of very good books. He, of course, began delving into the CIA mind control. And, of course, the next thing we knew, after a very minor incident in his early 30s, he died in the hospital. And then, of course, well, that can always happen. But then about a month or so later, why, his publisher died under very strange circumstances. And then shortly thereafter, his ex-wife died under mysterious circumstances. So sometimes a job like yours can be a very dangerous job. But I want you to keep right after it, because we'll put you on the air. You write the books, we'll give you a voice. So tell us then, as you begin looking into Carlyle, why you begin to find these strange relationships. You find George Herbert Walker Bush, is he a consultant or is he an employee?
He is a paid advisor. He's what's called a senior advisor, which makes him essentially an employee of this firm. I mean, he is someone who is collecting a paycheck from the Carlyle Group. He's very, very close with David Rubenstein, who is one of the co-founders, along with Stephen Norris. And the Rubenstein family and the Bush family have become very close over the past few years.
And my understanding is, of course, the George Herbert Walker is very close to the Bin Laden family, and I've heard that he stays over there at their enclave, their palaces or whatever they have, you know, when he's over there in Saudi Arabia. Do you ever heard anything like that?
I know he has been a guest of the royal family in Saudi Arabia. I don't know that he has actually stayed at the Bin Laden complex, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. George H.W. Bush has made many trips to the Middle East on behalf of the Carlyle Group. Some of those trips he's made with Secretary of State James Baker, some of those trips he's made with former UK Prime Minister John Major, and visiting these foreign countries on behalf of Carlyle is a very, very powerful tool for this company. They are able to have access to different types of investment, particularly government investments, that no other company would even be able to get their foot in the door in terms of competing for these things. So he plays a very active role in Carlyle's business, certainly has helped their business both in Saudi Arabia and throughout Asia.
Well, now, of course, as you point out, that they always hire people, very powerful people in government. John Major, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, is he an employee or is he a member of the board?
He's actually even tighter with the Carlyle Group than George H.W. Bush. John Major is the chairman of Carlyle Europe, which is a European subsidiary for Carlyle, and as such, he plays a very active role in identifying and securing investments for the Carlyle Group throughout Europe and the Middle East. So he's very, very involved in the day-to-day activities of this company.
Well, now, of course, they have a number of very key people, very important people associated with them. Would you like to sort of give our listeners an idea of who we're really talking about? Because this is the who's who of the power elite.
Right. So the thing you have to understand about the Carlyle Group, first of all, is that this is a company that invests in heavily government-regulated industries. So you're looking at defense, aerospace, telecommunications, healthcare, energy, things that are very much dependent on geopolitical events and legislation and policy that's handed down from Washington.
And, of course, war. I mean, they're very heavily invested in war. I know they were in Grumman as well, Grumman aircraft, as well as the other things we're talking about.
Absolutely. War is wartime is boom time for a company like Carlyle, which is the 11th largest defense contractor in the U.S. So all of these events that have been taking place recently, the war on terrorism, the September 11th attacks, the Afghan invasion, the Iraqi invasion, all of these things have meant some serious money for the Carlyle Group. And as such, they employ these high-level ex-politicians. It's what's known as the revolving door in Washington, D.C. politicians leave office, they join the Carlyle Group, and then sometimes, in some cases, they return to office, after 4 or 8 years pass.
Like Dick Cheney did with Halliburton, and he's
exactly.
still getting up. They call it a delayed salary or a deferred salary.
Deferred compensation. Right.
Halliburton is still paying the vice president, and maybe it's just coincidence that the government gave Halliburton a $600 million contract. Now, I understand that maybe because of some troublemakers like you, why, of course, Halliburton may lose that contract, but I'm sure that they won't be hurting. They probably make, $300 or $400 million instead of the full $600 million.
Right.
But some people might question why the vice president of the United States would get a deferred salary from Halliburton, and then Halliburton would get that very large contract. I mean, some people with a suspicious mind might think there might be a connection to that, especially since it was a no-bid contract.
Right. Well, it's not hard to sort of connect those dots. Now, the contract that Halliburton received is actually dates back to 2001. It's something called a log cap contract. It's something that's issued every 2 years by the government to one company to provide logistical support for the Army. Now, they received the contract to put the fires and get the oil infrastructure back in shape over in Iraq under the auspices of this log cap contract, and that's why there was no bidding on it. But certainly when you look at the relationship that Dick Cheney has had with this company over time, and the relationship that Halliburton and its subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root has had with the government over time, it does start to look like there is very little competition going on for these very, very lucrative and hefty contracts that are being issued. So it's not surprising that that people like Congressman Henry Waxman are looking into these things and demanding that that an investigation be conducted by the General Accounting Office to get to the bottom of these things, because this is our money, after all. This is taxpayer money that both Halliburton and companies like the Carlyle Group are trading on.
Yeah.
And we have very little transparency to see how it's being spent or how it's being dispensed.
Now, I think people have to know that, I mean, Dick Cheney was in the government, in the days of Richard Nixon, working for OEO and some of the other Office of Economic Opportunity. And then, of course, he is in Congress for a period, and then, of course, he gets into the Reagan administration. He stays on through the Bush administration. So all of his life he's been in a government job. And in 1992, he's out of work. And so what does he get? Does he get a job working for a major corporation? No. He is suddenly the CEO of Halliburton, one of the largest corporations. How do you get to suddenly be CEO of a corporation when you've never even worked in the corporation before? You've never even worked in the corporate world. Well, some people might be suspicious and think that was a payoff for services rendered, but I'm sure that wasn't the case. But I think it was just incidental, more than coincidence, that after Dick Cheney becomes the vice president, he's still getting a deferred salary from Halliburton. Why, of course, the $600 million contract comes along. But you'll feel better to know that, of course, they're going to renegotiate that, or maybe even put it up for bid now, because of troublemakers like our guest today, Dan. So anyway, why don't you tell us a little bit about this this Eskimo scam, it was a tax scam. Somebody wrote, they're always writing these laws, oh, we're going to tighten up the laws so there won't be any more opportunities for the wealthy not to pay their taxes. So they come up with this tax scam that if you are an Eskimo corporation, you can write off your tax losses, or the Eskimos can sell their tax losses to other people. Why don't you tell this incredible story of how we're tightening up the laws so that the corporations are going to have to pay their fair share of the taxes.
Right. So back in 1986, there was this loophole that you mentioned that allowed Eskimo-owned companies to sell their business losses to profitable companies for cash. So these Eskimo companies, which were hurting, losing a lot of money and needed cash infusions badly, were lining up to sell their losses to profitable companies that would then write those losses off and pay a nominal fee in cash in exchange for the tax write-off.
So you're selling your loss to somebody else so they can have the loss and you get the money for it.
That's right.
That's a pretty good way to do it. You and I couldn't do that, but
nope,
they're allowed to.
No, it's illegal, and it's illegal now to do that. But for a brief period of time in the late 80s, this loophole was open, and it was deftly exposed and exploited by David Rubenstein and Steve Norris, the two co-founders of the Carlyle Group. At the time, Steve Norris was working for Marriott Corporation, called on David Rubenstein, who was an aide in the Carter administration, who helped him find the Eskimo-owned companies, the loss-making Eskimos, and lined them up with various profitable companies. And they took a, 1 to 2% cut of the transaction. They ended up clearing about $10-20 million by funneling money through this tax loophole, and cost the United States government close to $1 billion.
Now, of course, this is perfectly legitimate, perfectly legal. They didn't do anything illegal. Of course, this loophole was put in there to benefit certain specific people, and by the law of unintended consequences, why we got Carlyle. Now, you're talking about, 86 or 87? This corporation starts, and today it's worth $16 billion. Only in America could this happen. And I'm not condemning making money. I think it's wonderful. It's simply how you make it, and you make it honestly, or do you make it by buying and selling people with power?
Yeah, and it's an extraordinary turn of events from that tax loophole through the 1990s. This company has been able to build itself up much faster than any private equity firm has ever done, into one of the most successful and powerful companies in the world, really. And they have done that by trading on political capital and peddling influence around the world.
And I remember when my friend told me about Carlyle, I think it only had $11 billion. And how much does it have now?
$16 billion under management.
Okay, well, a billion here, a billion there. But of course, what other things are they into besides war-making material? Because that, of course, was the big thing. You knew there was going to be a war, why you could make a lot of money.
Well, the defense business for them has been the cornerstone of the company, really. Excuse me, and that began shortly after the company was incorporated in 1987. They cast about for a couple of years, working on a couple of failed deals. They really didn't have what it took to succeed in the world of private equity until they hired a guy by the name of Frank Carlucci, whom you mentioned. Was the outgoing Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. So in 1989, Carlyle picked up Carlucci, and Carlucci steered them into the area of defense buyouts.
In fact, I have a very close friend who told me that he knew Carlucci very well, had worked with him. He said that was the most evil man he'd ever known. I think that's a good recommendation for this. Go ahead. So Frank Carlucci comes on, and he, of course, is going to be the head of this organization.
Right, so he comes on as chairman. And now, Carlucci has a very long history of working, subverting governments, foreign governments during the Cold War era, and has a very nasty reputation of being the guy behind the scenes that's sort of pulling the strings, particularly in revolutionary torn countries. He was implicated in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo after the Congo became an independent state. And the list goes on and on. He was deputy director of the CIA, secretary of defense, had a number of different government positions. So this was a guy who brought with him a considerable amount of clout and history and connections, but most importantly, a knowledge of the defense industry.
And, of course, a lot of connections and key positions in government, and especially in the CIA. Now, I think it's very interesting. You have Frank Carlucci, assistant director of the CIA. You have, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush, and what most people have forgotten, that George Herbert Walker Bush, in addition to being on the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, a member of the Trilateral Commission, attending Bilderberger meetings, a director, and of course he was the director of both the CFR and the Central Intelligence Agency. So we might talk a little bit when we got back about, is there possibly any CIA connection, as there was with BCCI and so many other organizations. We'll be back in just a moment here with Dan Brady talking about the Iron Triangle. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest today is Dan Priority. We're talking about his book, The Iron Triangle, and incidentally, this is available through Radio Liberty if you're out there across America and you'd like to get the book. It's a fascinating read, and it will give you some idea of this corporation which is above the law in many respects. Now, did you see any other CIA connections? I mean, George Herbert Walker Bush, director of the CIA, Frank Carlucci, assistant director of the CIA. Did you have that? Did that thought cross your mind anyplace?
Oh yeah, definitely. The CIA connections run pretty deep with this firm. In fact, one of the companies that they owned, a company called Bunnell Corporation, which many of your listeners may remember, is the company that was targeted and bombed in Riyadh just a couple months ago in the car bombing attack. Bunnell is a company that trains, is a military outsourcer, and they train the Saudi National Guard in combat techniques and fighting. Now, this company, I was told by someone who was on the board that it was a CIA cover-up company. It was a company that was designed to get CIA operatives into Saudi Arabia so that they could do reconnaissance there. With that kind of knowledge, it's not very surprising that it would be the target of these attacks. You know, in addition, George H.W. Bush, as a former president, still receives briefings from the CIA whenever he needs them. So with that kind of knowledge, with the knowledge of daily CIA briefings available to him, you know, imagine the kind of intelligence and information that the Carlyle Group is able to trade on. It's just it's hard to imagine them not being a successful $16 billion company.
But I'm sure that information is classified. You and I, he couldn't tell you or me about that, but I suppose that when you're the former president and you're the former director of the CIA, maybe the laws don't quite apply to you that would apply to the rest of us. So anyway, of course, I think that's fascinating as we begin to see this CIA front or a company is actually a part of the this menagerie, this group of corporations that are held by Carlyle. It's a holding company. They have a number of corporations underneath them, and of course they buy and sell them depending upon the profit availability. Maybe they just didn't know what they were doing when they bought that CIA front. So any other important connections of that sort?
Well,
That's important enough.
The most important connections, I think, that you have to look at are these political connections, those of Frank Carlucci and his relationship to Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell. You know, he's very close with both of these guys. In fact, he went to college with Donald Rumsfeld. He was wrestling partners and college roommates with Donald Rumsfeld at Princeton University. And Colin Powell was his protege for many of his years through government. So these guys are very close, and in the book it details a couple of correspondences that Donald Rumsfeld and Frank Carlucci have had, and that Colin Powell and Frank Carlucci have had, and it makes you wonder, you know, is Frank Carlucci acting as a private businessman? Because I do believe that our public officials should be allowed to get back into the private world and become successful businessmen if they want to after they've served their terms. But in this case, you know, you're looking at a guy like Frank Carlucci, it's very much unclear whether he's still in government or not. He's still advising some of our top officials in the White House on policy decisions while he's running this global corporation.
We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest is Dan Priority, and of course we're talking about, the Carlyle Corporation. Dan has written a fascinating book. It's called The Iron Triangle, and if you'd like to get that, you can, of course, want information on how you might get it. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And of course, Dan was saying that Vivendi Corporation, which is one of the many corporations owned by Carlyle, just happens to be a CIA front. In fact, one of the men who works for this organization said, yes, this is a CIA front. It was over there in Saudi Arabia, was training the people working for the Saudi government, all the things, the military things. So it trains the government, the military, and I suppose bodyguards, things of that sort. Is that what it does?
Yeah, exactly. They're a military outsourcer, so they, in this particular case, were hired to train the Saudi National Guard, which is the army that is in charge of protecting the royal family of Saudi Arabia, oftentimes against from its own people. And in this case, they were a target of terrorism both in 1995 and this past year because of their American roots and also because it is believed that they are a CIA cover-up operation.
Working in Saudi Arabia, right.
Right, and that has been confirmed to me by one of the former board members of the company.
All right, fine. So then this raises a little bit of question, but one of the most fascinating things is the list of people who are really associated with this organization. I mean, it's sort of a who's who of the elite of America. There are lots of other names there that you have listed.
Yeah, it's just a stunning concentration of wealth and power in one company. You know, besides George H.W. Bush, John Major, Frank Carlucci, James Baker. You've also got folks like Arthur Levitt. You know, this is a bipartisan sort of concern here. You've got Arthur Levitt, the former SEC director. You've got William Kennard, the former FCC chairman. You've got some people who are incredibly powerful in their own right, and have an inconceivable amount of knowledge about the industries in which the Carlyle Group is investing, and that's an advantage that no other private equity firm has.
And of course, if you know what's going to happen, and especially if you know what government policy is going to be, or if you might be able to influence that policy to the advantage of your new employer, that service is invaluable.
Right. So there's two ways that these guys are able to capitalize on the ex-politicians that they have on board. The first is, as you mentioned, that they may have insider knowledge about what the trends are going to be in terms of policy decisions that are being made on Capitol Hill. The other, and this is far more disconcerting, is that they may be able to actually influence those decisions. And like I was speaking about earlier, Frank Carlucci has certainly been able to reach into the Pentagon, reach into the State Department, and urge his friend Donald Rumsfeld or his former protege Colin Powell about making certain decisions towards, you know, various important important policy changes that are taking place, and that is what is, as an American, that's what really concerns me.
And of course, you actually have in the book several letters that Frank Carlucci has written to Donald Rumsfeld. How did you ever get those letters?
Well, we used a process called the Freedom of Information Act, in which you can solicit the government to provide documentation on specific events or on specific people. Of course, the government doesn't have to provide those documents. They only occasionally do, and they certainly don't give you anything that would be truly explosive material. But in this case, Judicial Watch, which is a public watchdog group in Washington, D.C., solicited those documents from the government and received them. Now, Judicial Watch is a very interesting organization. It was created during the Clinton administration. It's a very conservative organization, but very Republican-friendly, and was created essentially to expose Bill Clinton and to drive him out of office. They have since taken up the cause of the Carlyle Group and have demanded that George H.W. Bush resign from the company because of the conflict of interest that represents. And to see a conservative group like the Judicial Watch coming out against Carlyle Group was really a comment on how important this is.
Well, I think that honest people will be critical of anybody who is doing things that they shouldn't. And I know Larry Klayman. I've met him many, many times, and I spent time talking to him. And certainly I think that he believes that there's bipartisan treason, bipartisan betrayal. And so I respect him. We get a lot of people here who are just all pro-Democrat or they're all pro-Republican without realizing there is, of course, problems in both major political parties here in the United States. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dan Variety, and of course we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Don Variety. We're talking about his book, The Iron Triangle. It goes into the background of the Carlyle Group, and of course, you may or may not have heard of this, and yet it is certainly one of the most powerful and influential privately held companies in the world today, certainly one of the most wealthy. And of course, you commented that at one time, they had a public offering on one of the companies they held, and in one day they made $100 million or something like that?
Oh, well over that. They made $237 million that day, and since then have gone on to make over $800 million in profits. And the name of that company is United Defense, and a lot of your listeners may be familiar with the Bradley fighting vehicles and the Paladin gun systems, which were used to great effect during the Iraqi conflict. Both Iraqi conflicts, I should say. These guns and these gun systems are made by a company called United Defense, which is a Carlyle company. And the history of this company is truly remarkable.
Truly remarkable. Why don't you tell a little bit about that howitzer that nobody wanted?
Right. There was a gun called the Crusader, which was slated to be the replacement gun for the Paladin gun system. And the Army had signed a contract with United Defense back in the mid-90s. But by 1997, it was widely believed throughout Washington, D.C., and the Pentagon and the defense infrastructure that this gun was too slow and too heavy. It was a Cold War relic. It had to be shipped to a fight scene. It couldn't be flown in. And it just wasn't relevant for today's kind of hotspot warfare that the United States would be engaging in. So there was an effort on to kill this gun program from 1997 on to 2001. But remarkably, the gun program not only survived, but after the September 11th attacks, Carlyle was able to take United Defense public and make, like I said, $237 million in one day and close to $1 billion on paper, all told, after that IPO. Now, this was something that they never would have been able to do without September 11th. And in fact, in the prospectus for the public offering, they mentioned September 11th as a reason that they were taking the company public. And so shortly after that, the public furor over this gun system became so loud that the Defense Department was ultimately forced to cancel it because of the close ties to the Carlyle Group. It was a public relations liability, and Donald Rumsfeld made a very public statement about canceling the gun program in early 2002.
But of course, he didn't let his old friend Frank Carlucci down, did he?
Of course not. What wasn't as publicly noted was the fact that a brand new gun contract had been awarded to United Defense that very same day, and that gives you some idea of the safety net that United Defense was doing business over.
All right. So, in other words, I suppose that was a no-bid contract for the new gun that would replace the Crusader.
Well, there wasn't any other company that was making guns of that nature.
Right.
You know, the ultimate question was whether this was a gun that the Army really needed to have or not.
Well, a war is very, very profitable, unless, of course, you're one of the men who's out there fighting and bleeding and dying and being mutilated, or, of course, contracting the diseases, which so many of our fighting men who fought in the Gulf War have. A recent article by Colonel Hackworth on the TBR. N.org, the BarnesReview.org website, Colonel Hackworth writes that, you know, almost 200,000 of our Gulf War veterans came back or ill. Almost 10,000 of them died after the war. After the war, it was a great successful war. It was the diseases they contracted afterwards. We don't know what's going to happen to our boys over there now with the depleted uranium and the other things, and of course, but a lot of money has been made, and that's what really bothers me, Dan, is that I think there's some people who are really unconcerned about the immorality of war. They're more interested in the profits they're going to make than the suffering that they produce by the wars that they create.
Well, I think to even take that thought a step further is that, you know, this is our money that's being spent on these wars. This is our tax dollars that the government is allocating for these conflicts, and it's very, very expensive. And that money ultimately winds up in the hands of very, very few people, like the Carlyle Group, like Halliburton, like, you know, Bechtel, and the various other companies that capitalize on war. So, you know, this is really what war can be viewed as, this large-scale redistribution of the wealth from the American public into the hands of these very powerful, politically connected corporations.
And it's the political connections, really, that's so disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and that's, you know, that's something that I think the American people have come to a level of acceptance about, and that's what's so disturbing to me, is that, you know, it's getting very difficult to distinguish democracy from capitalism, certainly the way the Bush administration is promoting free trade throughout the world, and seems to think that free trade and open markets and is going to save, you know, all of these war-torn countries. Well, you know, who is the beneficiary of all of this free trade? It's the oil companies, it's the defense companies, it's the construction companies, and they're all politically connected. And you can no longer tell the difference. You can't tell where government ends and business begins anymore in the United States.
Well, of course, I believe in the free enterprise system. I believe in a free society. But I don't believe in a corporate socialist society where there is a covert relationship between the corporations and the government. And, of course, people who've been in government make tremendous profits, not because they're any smarter than anybody else, but because they're more ruthless, they're willing to compromise their position. They're willing to, of course, help their friends. And I think that this is best exemplified in a book that we carry, written by Bill Clinton's mentor, Professor Carol Quigley. The book was so good. It was somebody bought up the publisher and destroyed the place to the first half of the book. And we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story. The title, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. But on page 324, he tells about the central bankers and how they really control the governments and really manipulate the economies. And then, of course, it goes on page 324 to say, and, of course, it gets the support of politicians by giving them very lucrative jobs once they leave government service. In other words, a payment for services rendered. We see Bill Clinton making $10 million last year doing, of course, speeches. And then he gets a $10 million advance on a book he won't write himself. He'll get a ghostwriter to write it. And Hillary got $8 million for a book and ghostwriters wrote for her. And, of course, this is the way that the game is really played. And I don't mean to pick just on the Democrats, because, of course, it happens with both political parties. But, of course, the American people really don't understand how the game is played. You reward people for services rendered. Well, now, as far as the Carlyle Corporation is concerned, now, you and I couldn't go out and buy interest or stock in the Carlyle, could we?
No, it's a private company, and therein lies some of the problems in terms of transparency of this company. So first of all, this is the kind of investment that's open only to the very, very wealthy, either extremely wealthy individuals or to you know, institutional investors, public pension plans, stuff like that, that have hundreds of millions of dollars to invest.
Now, because this company started out about 15 years ago, what, about 1988, somewhere there?
1987, yep.
1987. It had maybe $20 million. It's now worth $16 billion. Now, the only person who talked to you was somebody named Stephen Norris. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what he told you about the early course of Carlyle, and then, of course, what happened to him. And, of course, that he's a little bitter, isn't he?
He is. His legacy was a bit tainted by being forced out of the company. But you know, Stephen Norris was an invaluable source for the book. He was co-founder of the company. He was with them through 1995. And during that time, he saw some amazing things happen. He saw this little company that was founded on a tax scandal.
The tax scam
build itself up into a very powerful player in the defense industry by acquiring people like Frank Carlucci or Fred Malik or Fred Malik was part of the Nixon administration and was also a Bush supporter and was part. Fred Malik was the man who was fingered as the man who counted the Jews for Richard Nixon when Richard Nixon was believed that there were Jews in the Bureau of Labor and Statistics that were undermining his presidency. Now, this came out later, well after the Nixon administration had already been disgraced and left office. Fred Malik was exposed as the man who actually did the counting of the Jews for Nixon, and when that happened, when that story broke in the Washington Post, Fred Malik was accepting a position as George Bush Sr.'s campaign director. Now, as soon as that story broke, he obviously resigned that post and went right back to the Carlyle Group, where he knew Steve Norris and was given shelter for the next couple of years by the Carlyle Group.
All right, fine. And so anyway, of course, this, Steve Norris is he's the co-founder of this fledgling corporation. And, you know, it's just making money hand over fist. And how did they really get started in these big government deals? Because they were just a couple of guys, you know. Certainly they were capable. David Rubenstein had been in government. Stephen Norris had worked for Marriott. They had an idea how to use this scam, this Eskimo write-off scam, to transfer the Eskimo losses and make them into profits, not only for other corporations, but for themselves. But they end up with $10, $20 million. So how did they really get this thing ball rolling to accumulate this vast, vast, vast wealth?
Well, the key cog in this machine was Frank Carlucci. When Frank Carlucci, after the Reagan administration was leaving office, David Rubenstein and Fred Malik and Steve Norris got together and were talking about who would be a good person to sort of cherry pick out of this administration and bring on board. And Fred Malik said, you know, Frank Carlucci is the guy. He's got all the connections. He's the one you want. So they struck a deal with Frank. They brought him over. And now Carlucci had spent most of his time as Secretary of Defense revamping the Pentagon's procurement policies. And at this time, the Cold War had recently ended, and nobody knew this defense industry better than Frank Carlucci. So he steered the company into the defense buyout business. They were able to make some very lucrative deals. They bought some, you know, down on their luck defense companies, which most of them were during this time of the peacetime dividend, so to speak, after the Cold War. They were able to pick up some of these companies very cheap, and then suddenly, of course, the Gulf War kicked in 1991, and the values of various defense companies began to skyrocket, and they turned those companies around. They made hundreds of millions of dollars, and suddenly they were legitimized as a private equity firm, and they realized the value of having all these politicians on board, and they started going after more and more.
No, I sort of wonder. There's a book, I think it's called Five Presidents by Bernstein and, pardon me, by Woodward, and of course it tells about how this meeting in the White House where James Baker III is there, and certainly George Herbert Walker Bush, he's the president, and of course they're trying, of course, not to have a war. This is the first Gulf War, and the Secretary of State at that time wants to go over and negotiate with Saddam and get him to pull out of Kuwait, and of course Herbert Walker Bush says, you're not going to go over there and negotiate a deal. We have to have this war. Those are the words that are quoted in the book. Anybody would like to see the page? Actually, it's quoted in one of my recent newsletters where we're talking about the background of the Gulf War. So George Herbert Walker Bush certainly wanted that war, and of course that was very, very profitable for his friends in the defense industry, wasn't it?
Yeah, and as any war is. So that's why you don't want to see a president that has too close of ties to the defense industry. You certainly would think that they would have an inclination to go to war when perhaps there were other viable solutions to avoid it. And that is the situation that we have right now. We have a president in office whose father works for the 11th largest defense contractor in the world. I would believe that he would have some sort of either subconscious inclination to go to war, and that's the conflict of interest that is raised with a company like the Carlyle Group, and that's what's so difficult to accept.
Well, of course, and there's recent articles that I'm reading about how we're going to have our troops stationed in Morocco and Tunisia and Uganda, Djibouti. I'm not sure where that is. That Ethiopia is over there somewhere along the Horn of Africa. We're going to have our troops stationed all throughout Africa. Now we're talking about taking them on into Liberia. So we'll have our troops stationed there. We have them in Uzbekistan and many of the Stan corporations in addition to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we're moving our troops into Eastern Europe. And, of course, we already have our troops all throughout Asia, certainly in Japan. I mean, what are we doing with 30,000 or 40,000 troops in Japan 50 years after the war? What are we doing with, of course, all these troops in South Korea all these years after the war when we're financing the North Vietnamese and giving them the food and we're giving them oil and we're building the nuclear plants for them? And then we say, gee, you're terrible guys. You're building nuclear weapons and we may have to go to war with you. And we've been financing the best enemies our money could buy for a long time. And, of course, that's great because, of course, we have to keep building more and more weapons to defend ourselves against some of these enemies that we've been financing for so long.
That's right. That's the cycle of the war business. And in order to continue to keep the war machine healthy and profitable, you have to continue to find reasons to go to war. And that's what this administration has shown a great ability to do.
Well, I'm really very, very concerned that, why are the American people, have they forgotten what war is all about? Certainly, everybody says, gee, this is a wonderful war, you know, less than 100 casualties, as we advance towards Baghdad. And yet, of course, the war continues. And the longer we stay there, the more people are going to lose their lives, both Arabs and Americans. But what really bothers me is the growing anti-American hatred throughout the rest of the world, as more and more people who've never before even considered becoming Islamic extremists are joining this Islamic fundamentalist movement with this aberration of Islam are embracing that because of their hatred of America. And every time we shoot some Arab over there in Iraq, justifiably or unjustifiably, we end up with probably 20 people in the family who will swear revenge against us because their religion is built upon not love as Christianity is, but upon revenge. And of course, we don't understand their psychology, and we're going over there trying to remake their educational system. They weren't concerned about their educational system. We are. We want to make their health system. They weren't concerned about their health system. We were. But, of course, we can't get the electricity and the water flowing for them. And, of course, more and more and more bitterness building up. And we still haven't found the weapons of mass destruction. So you have to ask, do you think that sometimes the government doesn't tell the American people the full truth?
Well, I think the more time that goes by that the weapons of mass destruction are not found, and the more doubt that's cast upon the intelligence that the Bush administration used to justify the war, the more people will start to turn to the alternative reasons for the war, which were just a murmur during Bush's campaign for the war, but now seem more and more viable, like the corporate interests in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly the oil interests in both countries. And those things become more and more of front page news the longer this process of discovery continues that the Bush administration misled the American people and the world into this war. And even with that information, that disinformation, as it now appears to be, so much of the world was not convinced that there was a case for war to begin with. So we are alienating ourselves from the rest of the world, and I think that's a very dangerous thing to do.
Well, the president said, we just couldn't wait any longer. It was an emergency because Saddam Hussein might attack us with these weapons of mass destruction or give them to Osama bin Laden or the other terrorist movement to attack us with, and that's why we had to go in. And it was a matter of extreme emergency. We couldn't wait another week. We had to do it right now. And, of course, they're sort of I'm sure Osama bin Laden is rubbing his bony hands together, chortling about how we have helped him recruit more and more people into the radical Islamic movement than ever before. Well, what message would you like to leave with our listeners about the Carlyle Corporation, about this corporation that seemed almost a decade, a half ago, to know that we were going to war in the Middle East?
Just that, people should should believe their gut reaction when they see these kind of connections between a company and a government, that this country and other countries have gone to war for far less than money, and believe that it could be the case in this case that we have committed our troops to this battle for the almighty dollar.
Well, of course, you believe that it's a financial desire rather than some other purpose, then.
I do. I mean, I do think that that the administration may believe that the best thing for America is to keep our corporations healthy, and certainly to keep our energy industry healthy. And the only way to do that is to establish a stronghold in the Middle East. I do believe that those are the real reasons why we went to war in Iraq. But they may or may not be right about that, but we shouldn't have been misled about their intentions. And if they did have imperialistic notions about the invasion of Iraq, they should have come clean with them.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest is Dan Brady, and of course his book is The Iron Triangle. And if you'd like to know more about that or how you might be able to get that, certainly 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Now, one of the explanations, though, the justifications would be, look, we are involved in a war on terrorism, and of course the only way we're going to be able to stop this whole war on terrorism is to get our troops over there and put an end to the major countries that are really financing this whole thing. And of course, forget about Iraq financing Islamic terrorism. The real centers of this are Iran and Saudi Arabia. And if we have our troops there, we can either topple those governments, or we can certainly let them know in certain terms that if they don't stop financing Al-Qaeda as they have in the past, and believe me, both of those countries are involved, and we have multiple books on that. And if you haven't read the books like Dollars for Terror, or certainly Hatred's Kingdom, the story of Saudi Arabia, written by the former ambassador to the United Nations, Gregor Gold, you need to. And of course, when you read this, you understand that certainly the Saudis have been financing this. Bin Laden, the man who declared war against America, by Yosef Badansky, points out the close relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So how about the explanation that, look, we're really over there involved in the war on terrorism, and we're going to, make sure that Iran is put down once and for all, and they get a democratic government in there. And we're going to do the same thing with Saudi Arabia, because only with democracy will we have regimes there that are not financing people who threaten our people, who threaten the survival of America. How would you respond to that explanation?
Well, I don't think the same thing that happened in Iraq could ever happen in Saudi Arabia. Iran, I'm not so sure about, but take Saudi Arabia for example. There are so many American business interests that are doing business freely and successfully and profitably, that there would be a major uproar if America were to take the stance against Saudi Arabia that it has against Iraq. Though in terms of terrorism, it would certainly be much more justifiable than going after Iraq. So it is clearly the business interests of the United States, particularly the oil companies, and certainly companies like the Carlyle Group have large stakes in the economy of Saudi Arabia. I do believe that those business interests protect Saudi Arabia from the same kind of treatment that America has given to Iraq or Afghanistan.
But of course, the major funding, both before and after 9/11, for Al-Qaeda came from Saudi Arabia. I don't think there's any question about that, at least not according to the book Hatred's Kingdom and many other sources we have. So, and the president has said, you're either for us or you're against us, and we're not going to put up with any country that's financing Islamic terrorism. If we don't do something about Saudi Arabia, this whole Islamic terrorist movement will continue, and the government will continue taking away our freedom in the name of fighting Islamic terrorism, whereas, of course, it's being funded by our good buddies, the Saudis. So there's something wrong with this picture. I don't care how many business interests you have, just as Americans had business interests in Germany before the Second and during the Second World War. The survival of our free world depended upon taking out Adolf Hitler. At least that's what we're told.
I agree with you, Dr. Stan, but I have to say that the only explanation that makes any sense to me about why we have treated Saudi Arabia with kid gloves is just that we just have too much of a financial stake already in that country, and there is a symbiotic relationship between the two economies, and America is not willing to, or the government at least, is not willing to throw that into disarray.
Well, I think that there's a lot more here than I think meets the eye, and I think you've done a great job in your expose at the Carlyle Group, and of course the book is The Iron Triangle, and I recommend it. It's well done, very factual, well documented, and of course based upon first-hand information obtained from Stephen Norris, who was the co-founder of the Carlyle Group, and was eventually, how was he forced out, or do we have any idea?
He had a conflict, a personality conflict with one of the other eventual partners in the firm, a guy by the name of William Conway, who came over from MCI, and the two of them didn't see eye to eye, and it grew to be a serious problem, and eventually the other partners asked him to leave.
All right. Well, did he get a financial buyout? After all, he was one of the founders of it.
I'm sure he did, but it was nothing that he was willing to share with me.
All right. Fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us and for sharing your knowledge of that. And certainly I'm looking forward. What's the next book you're in the process of writing now?
Writing a book about Halliburton, right?
About Halliburton. Well, have you interviewed Dick Cheney on that?
I have not had a chance to interview the vice president yet.
All right, fine. Well, I'll be very interested in what you find out about Halliburton. And, of course, what happens, really, we have these corporations that the question is, are they subservient to government, or is government subservient to them? And, of course, when you have corporations and government being one, you have a situation very, very similar to what we saw in Mussolini's Italy, where corporate socialism, the government supported the corporations supported the government, and Benito Mussolini ruled happily, at least until the end of the Second World War. Thank you so much for being with us, David. And when you get that other book, will you be sure to let me know? Because I'd love to do an interview with you. And I suspect that I won't see a book review in the pages of the New York Times.
Oh, I wouldn't be too sure of that. They reviewed the Carlyle Group book, and I would expect them to do the same with the Halliburton
really,
book.
Really? I didn't see it there. Well, I thought I read all the books. Well, of course, I don't read
the Sunday
book.
In the business
reviews.
Section.
No, I read the daily one. I don't take the Sunday Times. But I think 5-6 days of the Times is about all I can take. Anyway,
yeah.
God bless. Thanks very much for
being here. Thanks, Dr.
Stan. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our interview with Dave Variety this evening, and a discussion of The Iron Triangle, a very important book that'll give you the background of what's going on. And I am pleased to see the New York Times did review the book, even though I didn't find it there.
I'm not even sure
how we did find about the fascinating story of the Carlyle Group that, of course, really is above the law. And, of course, I think what David has brought out, apparently what Dan has brought out, of which nobody else has brought out, is the close relationship between the Central Intelligence Agency and this organization that operates behind the scenes, just as the BCCI, the Bank of Criminals and Congressmen, well, that was what it really stood for, but that certainly was BCCI, the biggest banking scandal of all time. It was really a CIA front. Why, of course, we must ask the same question about the meteoric rise of Carlyle. Well, it's out of time. And to our listeners up north, we're going to have to say goodnight. If you'd like a free copy of any of our newsletters, my March newsletter will tell you the truth about why we really went into Iraq, which I didn't want to get into with our guests this evening, but certainly you have to understand the spiritual aspect of everything going on. So we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back again tomorrow evening. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here, not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And let me remind you, of course, you can listen to our programs 5 hours every day on the Internet simply by going to our website, which is RadioLiberty.com. I talked to another person today who listens to us 5 hours a day. I ran into a fellow last week who listens 5 hours a day and most days, and a very nice woman from Southern California will be having us a guest here. Sue will be with us for several programs, and she listens 5 hours every day. Now, you don't have to listen 5 hours a day, but at least hopefully you can listen at least 1 or 2 hours a day. And of course, we encourage you to tell others about our program, encourage them to listen, to begin to get the truth that they're not going to get from, as my friend John Lefter says, Peter, Dan, and Tom. So, you know, but right now we have with us on the line from Sacramento, from the Campaign for California Families, your good friend and mine, Randy Thomas. And hi, Randy, how are we doing?
Hey, Dr. Stan, pretty good. There's a lot of things happening.
All right. Well, that's why we have you on here, to keep us abreast of what's really going on. You know, I've been reading about up in Sacramento, they've got a wonderful way to balance the budget. They're just going to borrow all the money so the future generations will have to pay it back, and then they won't be there when it all comes due.
You know, you'd never get that past my table on that. At my kitchen table, we have to say, is this a need or a want, and we have to not go on credit. Unfortunately, a lot of people go on credit, but it's no way for our government to do it, because they have a way to balance the budget ethically and with standards and not hurting future generations. The only safe way to go is to cut wasteful spending. There's plenty of it. And if Gray Davis can find some cuts, well, there's a lot more that can be found as well.
All right, fine. I'm sure there can be. And, but I think it's really when you stop and realize that we are bankrupt, they've lowered our bond rating. We are among the three lowest states in the entire union today, I think right along with New York, and I'm just not sure.
Louisiana is the other.
All right, fine. Well, of course, but what that does is going to cost us an extra $400 million a year because we have to pay so much more for the bonds. And how much are they going to borrow now? Was it $10 billion or something like that to try to balance the budget?
Yeah, it's going that direction. I'll tell you, I think one of the only good news things today was that there's going to be a recall of Governor Gray Davis. I mean, we're just not sure when, whether it's in the fall or early next year, but over 1.2 million signatures have been collected, and the signature gathering effort is declaring victory. And everyone, including Governor Gray Davis and all the Democrat leaders and now all of the media, are acknowledging the same thing, that there will be a recall election in California.
Well, isn't that interesting? And of course, I would hope that this would be a message to the politicians that the people of this state are sick and tired of the fact that they've destroyed the economy of this state, that major corporations have picked up and many of them are leaving. And of course, the solution is not to raise the taxes. It's to do away with the excessive spending, to get the taxes cut, to certainly reform the workmen's compensation laws, to take away the environmental restrictions, to get government off the backs of people and out of their pocketbooks and let them be free. Otherwise, of course, they are going to be retired early and they're not going to get all the benefits of being up there in Sacramento, where they get a car and they get per diem and they get a big fat salary and they get a big fat staff and an opportunity, of course, to make a lot of money on the side from all the favors they do.
Yeah. Well, it's a good description of corruption, I'll tell you that.
Okay, well, tell us about your view of what's going on up there.
Well, I'll tell you, we just got back from a statewide tour, which you may have read about, a motorhome tour of the state. We held 23 news conferences in a two-week period. And Dr. Stan, I'm just celebrating and thanking God for the media coverage. Over 60 individual media stories were written, aired, or broadcast through newspapers, radio, and television news reports, all about AB 205, which is the homosexual marriage bill. It awards all the rights of marriage under state law to homosexual partners and rejects the vote of the people. And it just keeps mushrooming, Dr. Stan. There was a big article in the Sacramento Bee on Sunday, the widest circulation, a big story, calling this bill the, quote, gay marriage bill, and the message is getting out. And then yesterday, there's the largest newspaper in the state of California called La Opinion, which wrote a 30-paragraph story, a major article in Spanish reaching the majority of Spanish readers in the state with an expose about this homosexual marriage bill. And I'd like to quote from just part of it if I could.
Sure, go ahead, but please quote in English.
I will quote in English because I don't know all Spanish. I know a little bit about La Familia and La Voto de la Californians. Es muy importante. However, I will speak in the English. In this article, it said, according to opponents, AB 205 violates Proposition 22, adopted by the majority of Californians as a defense of marriage. Quote, in 9 years, the Latinos will be the majority in the state. We have decided that we want marriage to be between a man and a woman, said Luis Galdamez, Latino spokesman for Campaign for California Families. He continued saying, we are people with tradition and culture. Our religion is important. AB 205 is not something we are in favor of. Quoting myself, AB 205 reverses the vote of the people and moves forward gay marriage under state law, said Randy Thomason, executive director of Campaign for California Families. Quote, it awards all the rights of marriage to homosexual partners. And it goes on and on, and this is in the largest Spanish newspaper in the state. And I just want to thank the people who support us, and thank God for this opportunity, because we're reaching the Latinos, the emerging majority of California, with the truth. And again, remember, an overwhelming majority of Latino voters supported marriage 3 years ago on the ballot, and they don't want AB 205. As California goes, so goes the nation. We don't want to see AB 205 passed and signed by Governor Gray Davis. He's got only 21% of the electorate who supports him, and the recall is just they've collected enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. It's a process. But Governor Gray Davis, he needs to veto this bill, I'll tell you that.
Well, I think we want to suggest that people contact him. Is that what you had in mind?
Absolutely. In fact, I'll give out the phone number for Governor Gray Davis. He has a message machine. You can even leave a message tonight, I believe. The phone number for Governor Gray Davis is 916-445-2841. 916-445-2841. If you're listening to Dr. Stan in California, please give him a ring, call Governor Gray Davis, and urge him to veto AB 205. This bill turns marriage upside down. Even if you don't believe that marriage should only be for a man and a woman, the democratic process that people voted to protect marriage, the state has no right to turn around the vote of the people. Again, please oppose AB 205. Call Governor Gray Davis at 916-445-2841.
2841, 2845.
2841. That's 916. One more time. 916-445-2841.
2841. Okay, fine. If you got that telephone number, if you didn't, why, you call Dale on the board, and I'm sure he'll get that for you. Anything else you want to bring out?
Well, just visit our website at savecalifornia.com. Read all the stories about the media, the coverage of the Protect Marriage Tour. We don't do it to promote ourselves. We do it to promote the values that made America great. And we're just promoting the best values the world has ever known. And we do thank God for what is going on to get the light of truth out, to expose the darkness. Is a function of light, and the people do need the truth, and the people need their vote on marriage protected. Dr. Stan, it's an amazing battle. You live in California, so do I, and we've just got to stand up for what is true.
All right, fine. Well, thanks very much, Randy. God bless you for everything you do. Our guest has been Randy Thomason, Campaign for California Families, a one-man dynamo out there on the front line fighting for God, family, and country. Thank you so much, Randy.
Thank you, Dr. Sam.
All right, let's go now to our good friend Brad Dacus from Pacific Justice Institute. Hi, Brad. How goes the battle for freedom?
Oh, just great, Dr. Stanley. We have some good news to report. To start off with, we at the Pacific Justice Institute, we're dealing with a matter down in Fremont, actually Newark, which is right near Fremont, and a church there, Fremont Bible Fellowship, wanted to move on to a building there.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, you're going to have to... Hello? I'm going to have to go ahead and get him back again. I'm sorry, that was my fault. So anyway, down in Newark, there we are. Hi, Brad, I'm sorry, I pushed the wrong button.
Now,
you'd think that after all this time, I wouldn't do that. But anyway, go ahead. There in Newark, what happened?
Yeah, so in Newark, California, there in the Bay Area, the Planning Commission voted almost unanimously to prevent a church from being able to occupy a building. The church was Fremont Bible Fellowship, and the church was moving on to it, acquiring it. And what happened was the church contacted us. We got one of our local experts on this area of church land use issues into it. And to make a long story short, the real pleased to announce that the Newark City Council reversed the Planning Commission unanimously and agreed to allow this church to move into their community and occupy a building and really start impacting. So it's real nice, and you know, if it wasn't for that religious land use statute that we've been using over and over again, I'm not sure it would have turned out this way. So we're real positive about that. The other thing I wanted to mention was one thing that's going on in the legislature that we at Pacific Justice Institute have weighed in on, and that's a bill, it's AB 1012. I'm not sure if Randy mentioned this last because there's so many different bills, but this is a bill that would require police officers, before they interrogate little children at elementary schools, to let parents know about it, and so that parents can be there with their kid, and because it can be very, you know, traumatic for a child, to at least let the parents know about, so the parents can be there for their child. And some school districts already have that policy, but many, like LA Unified, Los Angeles Unified, don't. And so we appeared there, the only pro-family organization there representing the parents on this bill. And we're hopeful that it will make it to the governor's desk now. We're optimistic about Governor Gray Davis, but we're at least hopeful at this time it'll make it farther than it ever has.
All right, fine. Well, Brad, I certainly appreciate everything you're doing. I want to get your telephone number and your website out there.
You bet. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129. And our webpage is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org. And I encourage people to contact their state representative and just encourage them to support AB 1012. It's a real parents' protection legislation we hope goes through.
All right. God bless you. Thanks very much, Brad.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, our next guest this evening, of course, is Bill Sardi. And Bill is a frequent guest on our program here. And, of course, we're going to be talking about, well, all sorts of things. And Bill is always a fascinating source of information on health and health matters. But, you know, I thought maybe this evening we might just talk a little bit about all these new diseases that are popping up. Have you noticed that there are all these new diseases that have never been seen before? Not only that, but all these new diseases that have never been seen before do something that diseases have never done before, and that is they cross the species barrier, and they infect multiple animals, and they affect birds, and they also affect human beings. Now, we did not see this until well prior to the 1960s, very, very rarely. There were a few diseases, certainly some of the equine encephalitis, St. Louis, Japanese encephalitis. But of course, these diseases really were in horses, but then, of course, they were carried by mosquitoes. They didn't jump directly. They jumped to mosquitoes. Certainly rabies went from the animals to humans, but most diseases did not. Most diseases were, either animal diseases, they were retroviruses, and then, of course, they were aviary diseases, usually retroviruses, but retroviruses did not infect human beings until of recent years. And this is really, of course, it's an amazing, amazing study as you begin to get the back of it. And I wonder how many of you have seen the film Outbreak. It was shown again on television this last weekend. And I would suggest that if you haven't seen it, get it, because it tells you an amazing, amazing story. Outbreak, of course, is a fictional story of a major outbreak of a retrovirus. In fact, if you look at the picture that they had in the movie, it looks just like the Ebola virus. And interestingly enough, the outbreak initially was in Africa someplace. And of course, in 1967, and when the government went in, identified the virus, took blood specimens, and then because the infection was so highly contagious, why they simply dropped a bomb and killed everybody in the building. In the village, but they never let the public know about this or know about the virus. And of course, they had this virus, and it did not appear again until 1976, when it appeared in a village in Zaire. And of course, at that time, it was initially it was passed from individual to individual, but it wasn't contagious by aerosol. In other words, coughing, you couldn't get it. You had to touch people or come in contact with blood or certainly with blood or personal contact. Well, first, the story was Dustin Hoffman, and you'll have to see the story. I don't want to give it away. But of course, it becomes very obvious to Dustin Hoffman that the government had the virus all the time. It was using it for biowarfare purposes. It had a treatment for it, and it was concealing it and letting people die when the outbreak came here in the United States following the 1976 outbreak. Very well done. A lot of truth in it, because, of course, the original outbreak of a Marburg-like disease was in 1967, only it wasn't in Africa. It was a place called Marburg, Germany, and one other laboratory, and it came from a shipment of monkeys from Africa, but it doesn't exist in monkeys in the wild. And then, of course, the disease disappeared after it was controlled in Marburg, Germany, and the one other European city, only to reappear in Africa in a village in Zaire on the Ebola River. And, of course, that's why they call it Ebola virus. Well, and, of course, then it occurred there, but it was a different variant than the original variant. And at the same time, another outbreak in the Sudan, exactly the same time, 1976, and it was a third variant of the virus. And then, of course, those are brought under control. But one of them, the one in Zaire, is so lethal, 90% lethal. I think 210 of 200 or 211 of 237 people who are infected die of it. 90% fatal. 0.5% people die in the Sudan. And then, of course, a sporadic outbreak since then. And then, of course, but never the disease is found in monkeys. The CDC says they found some antibodies in some of the monkeys, but nobody else in the world can. And then, of course, in 1989, suddenly there's an outbreak in Reston, Virginia, in an animal laboratory, and all the monkeys are dying of the same disease. But this disease doesn't infect any human beings because it only infects monkeys. So where do all the strains of the disease come from? Well, of course, there were two other outbreaks then, in Pennsylvania and Texas, in animal laboratories. Only in animal laboratories, it only infects animals. So now we have a disease that only infects animals. We have a disease that infects animals and human beings, maybe 25% lethal, 20% lethal. We have a disease that's 50% lethal. We have a disease that's 90% lethal. We have no idea where all these strains come from, other than, of course, we know the original strains came out of a laboratory in Africa called Litton Bionetics, or at least according to Dr. Hurwitz, it's Litton Bionetics. And, of course, Litton Bionetics worked for a laboratory that worked for the Special Virus Cancer Project, which was affiliated with the CIA. So these are the things we know. And right now we've got, of course, Bill Sardi online with us. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Okay, fine. Well, what should we talk about this evening? What things do you think are the major issues we ought to bring out to our listeners?
Well, certainly so far in the news this evening, something out of Britain. It doesn't seem to be hitting the news wires here yet. Now, maybe by the morning they'll really have to fess this one up, because apparently, as many of you know, there's some sort of a flap going on between Tony Blair in England, the head of the English government, and, of course, the British Broadcasting, as to whether claims about weapons of mass destruction were sexed up, as they call it. This was the claim they used in Britain. By their administration there, in order to, you know, justify the war. Of course, the BBC is holding by their claim and standing up the government. Blair is asking them to stand down and to straighten up things. And now it turns out that the White House here on our side of the ocean has conceded that the claim that Iraq was trying to get some sort of a processed uranium from a country in Africa, Niger, that all was false, that President Bush did use and refer to this false statement about uranium in his State of the Union address. It should have not been used there, says the White House this evening. But they're also admitting that Western intelligence services knew that this was a falsehood early in the year 2002. And therefore, this puts a giant, it really stabs Tony Blair in the back, because Blair is the one who used this claim. And so now the White House, essentially on the backhand, is saying that Blair, they didn't come out and use it in words, but they just made it more difficult for Blair to maintain his claim. There's been a big flap in Britain over this. What's interesting is, as you go to the news wires this evening, this is not on Associated Press here on our side of the ocean. It's not on the New York Times wire. It's not on the Washington Post. Usually you can access these at this hour. Tomorrow's online news is online today here at this hour on the West Coast. So we have no evidence of it on the news wires yet. Now, it may be on television tonight or something, or they may find out they have to say something about this instead of just ignoring it. But apparently at this point, the United States, the White House, is conceding that President Bush used misinformation in his State of the Union address. The CIA is the one who leaked the information and said, no, that we had information as early as 2002, that all this information was false. It's not a matter that it was a false information and that the White House found out about it later. We knew that early on, and therefore this information never should have been used. So therefore, Tony Blair and George Bush really got egg on their faces. Blair is in worse trouble, and his majority is shrinking in his government. He had a majority of 160 or so in his in Parliament, and I think it's down to 36. So he's suffering a crisis in confidence, and Bush is hoping to waylay this by just admitting it was a mistake and taking it on that way. So we will see what the opposition party does, what the Democrats do here. And, of course, it's just interesting how the news media handles this, because you're just not reading or hearing anything about it yet. Now, we'll see. Maybe they will do something with it.
Well, you know, I think it's really so interesting that if you go back, and I have collected all of these speeches by the president, and he says, you know, this is an emergency. I mean, after all, Saddam Hussein may decide to attack us with these weapons of mass destruction. We can't let him have these weapons of mass destruction that he can attack us or turn over to Al-Qaeda so they can attack us. We can't wait another week. We can't wait another day. We've got to attack now. And, of course, people have forgotten what the rhetoric was. Now, I don't think that George Bush writes any of his speeches. I don't think that George Bush is allowed even to do a press conference without having the whole thing scripted. And as I pointed out in previous programs, the press conference was done immediately before we went to war. And those of you who saw that may remember the president reading a prepared statement and then, of course, taking questions from the reporters. But he wouldn't look out of the audience and say, hey, Pete, you're next, or we'll take your question. He'd look down at the script and say, Pete, you're next. He'd look up, and Pete would stand up. And Pete wouldn't ask a question. He had it all written out on a little script in front of him. He would ask the president the question. George Bush would look down, get the answer, and read it back. And then, of course, he would go, John, I think you're next. And he's not looking at John. He's looking at the script. Everything was scripted. And I believe, of course, that everything the president says in a major speech is scripted for him. Now, we have, I think, fairly reliable information that certainly Saddam had both chemical and biological weapons, which, of course, we'd given to him. We had sold him during the 1980s. And, of course, those were all moved into Syria, of course, according to Joel Skousen, why there are NSA satellite pictures that show the columns going in. I broached this subject with Dor Gold, the former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and made this statement to him. Well, now, my understanding is, of course, that the weapons of mass destruction have been moved into Syria. Have you heard that? And he said, oh, of course, yeah, of course, they've been moved to Syria. I did the same thing with Avi Lifkin, who was associated with Israeli intelligence for many years. He had exactly the same response. So, I mean, if I know it, and if Avi Lifkin knows it, and of course Dor Gold knows it, and Joel Skousen knows it, we know that the American intelligence know where the weapons of mass destruction are. And why is it that nobody is telling the president? Because I don't think George Bush knows where they are. I don't think, in fact, there was a recent meeting over, it was quoted by Joel Skousen, where George Bush was asking, I mean, who's in charge of looking for these weapons of mass destruction? Where are we going to find them? Where are they? And he looks at Tommy Franks, and Tommy Franks says, I'm in charge of the military. And he looks at somebody else, and they say, well, that's not my job. And they say, well, maybe it's Donald Rumsfeld. Maybe the CIA ought to look for them. And the question is, of course, why are they, somebody is out to, destroy Tony Blair. I think what they want to do is show that they can destroy any politician they want to if he, of course, looks at them cross-eyed, or I think he doesn't even have to look at them cross-eyed. They'll just destroy him for the fun of it. These powerful people who work behind the scenes, of course, and I think it's fascinating that Tony Blair is in as much trouble as he is. Maybe it's because, of course, he's not going along with the European Union or, going along with the taking the European the British currency into the European Union. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure that if they're doing this, Tony Blair, it's for a specific purpose, and it will further the cause of the New World Order and the uniting of Europe, and certainly not the cause of individual freedom. What are your thoughts on that? Because there's a reason why they're after Blair. This thing would never be getting the play it is.
Well, there certainly would be a reason why they turned on this man who really had the party line to go along with the war. So for them to turn around like this, you have to ask a question. What did he not go along with? Maybe the currency thing is an issue there with the trying to make the euro a one currency, these kind of things. Of course, he's going to have a hard time with that anyway, because the British people, this was the problem. We all blame the French government for not going along and supporting the war in Iraq. The leaders there had no choice. 80% of the people weren't for it and weren't convinced of it. So you try to stay in power and have 80% of the voters that have been kicking you out. So they had no choice as leaders of that country. Blair did go against the war, did go for the war and against his populace and won over on the war, but now he's not winning on the cause of the war, and so this is turning around on him, and he certainly has a populace that doesn't go along with the euro. They don't want that. And so he's got some unpopular things to buck, and how he can stay in power and still buck the public is, of course, very difficult. Maybe they want some sort of a change in order to do something there. It's hard to know.
Well, I think his popularity will probably catch up with Governor Davis here in California before long. I think Governor Davis has got about a 22% popularity rating on the latest poll. So, it's amazing how the status of a politician varies, from time to time. But, of course, they're dramatizing this. They keep hammering away day after day about what Blair had done. If the media would, of course, leave him alone, there wouldn't be a problem. The media in England is controlled just like it is here. But, of course, it's not necessarily controlled by exactly the same people. So they all have their agendas. They certainly use their power to destroy politicians. And we'll be back right after the break here. at Radio Liberty and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and we're just sort of talking about, well, I hadn't heard this thing about Tony Blair, but of course I know that he's certainly been on the hot seat. A lot of people are asking why it was he insisted there were weapons of mass destruction, why they put out information that had been gotten from a student at the Monterey Language School 10 years ago as a documentation for the existence of these weapons of mass destruction. So, you know, there are a lot of interesting questions, but the biggest question is, why are they bringing this up? Because you could squelch that story very easily. The people who control the media squelch all sorts of stories, and we never hear about them. So we don't even know there's a problem. Other stories, they'll hammer away at day after day after day. They wanted to get Trent Lott out of a position of leadership and put in Bill first. And so Trent Lott makes a casual remark at a private meeting. And, of course, it's blown all out of proportion. He's a racist, you know. And, of course, that is hammered away at day after day after day until he's forced out of a position of leadership in the United States Senate. Obviously, there was an agenda behind what happened. And I think there's an agenda behind getting rid of Tony Blair, if that's what's going to happen. The question is, what is it? And I think that's up for grabs. It could be, Bill has suggested, having to do with the bringing England into the European Union. I don't know what it is. But right now we've got Nathan, of all people, on the line. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Hi. Good evening, doctors. Can you both hear me?
We can both. I can. Can you hear Nathan, Bill?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Well, Dr. Monteith and Dr. Sardi, this is astonishing news. You know, I first heard about this admission on your program, and I went and confirmed it in the next room with the people who watched the news today. So apparently, yes, this was a true admission. The interesting thing, though, is it would seem as though they not only want to get the British Prime Minister out of there. Oddly enough, it would also seem like a move to get Bush out of there, that maybe he's been manipulated in all of this, just the same as Tony Blair, and that, in fact, you know, the real people behind the scenes have wanted to remove him and perhaps put people who are more fully their own people in there as a possibility. Now, I could be naive, but...
Bush is so popular. I mean, they've created such an aura about him. He has the full support of the Christian conservative. He's getting the support of the homosexuals as he appoints them to key positions. He's getting the support of the pro-life people because of what he says. He's getting the support of the pro-choice people because of what he does. I mean, he is doing an amazing job. He's getting more and more support among the Hispanics and blacks. He's a shoo-in in the next election. You know, if the economy stays up, he's already collected, I don't know how many, millions of dollars. You know, we're pushing $100 million already. Maybe it's even more than that in preparation for the next election. I can't imagine that they would be trying to get rid of him now. But I'm not certain. What do you think, Bill?
Well, I can't imagine him being pushed out. And of course, as I've said before, I'd get very scared if he wasn't the popular president at this point. Because, as we've said in the wag the dog scenario, you know, we have a president and a party that's really running on a war and terrorism campaign, and they're just likely to, you know, beat the drums up a little more and scare more yellow alerts, more red alerts. I mean, you know, in a time when we're unsure, we vote in the incumbent. So, you know, these kind of things just... We probably lose if we have any will in the country. I don't know, you can... prevail over these kind of powerful people and who's really in charge. I doubt if we can, but I do know he's very popular. He's going to wave the American flag. He's going to say that we need to stand behind the country and against terrorism. And anybody who looks soft on it, he's going to make any opponent look soft on it. So it's going to be difficult. I can't imagine Bush not winning an overwhelming second term, but there seems to be some dissension here. There seems to be something at odds between the Pentagon, the CIA, and the White House. There seems to be some tug and pull here that's going on. There seem to be some cards that are shown either to the news media or other places. So So some embarrassing moments are coming out, and there's some reasons for these, because those three branches are not always getting along.
Now, maybe they're going to suddenly find those weapons in Syria. I think one of these days we're going to find them in Syria. Anyway, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I think there's a perspective on this, though, that you gentlemen, I would recommend that you consider.
All right.
There seem to be, right now, let's say about four major obstacles, quote unquote, to a one world order that are to be removed. One of them would be, of course, isolationists in the United States, the majority of whom support President Bush. Now, he may himself be a globalist, but he has a lot of his support among the Christian conservatives, as you say, and the isolationists, so-called. The other would be, of course, the government of Israel, which is not allowing the globalists to control the Temple Mount, or at least is, in some sense, is trying to resist. The third would be the red atheistic tyranny of China, and the reason being that it is isolationist. It's a more national socialist than it is international socialist. And the fourth might very well be the Vatican. Okay, in other words, it desires its own version of it. It's not going along with modernism and all of its manifestations. What if you just get all these just sort of set against each other, and you get the Muslims? They too are a barrier because they're fanatical and they're religious. They're not going along. They don't bow before the idols of modernity. And so what if you just get these different elements fighting against each other, and then you just sort of get them all out of the way, and then you step in, and voila. It seems to me that that's what's going on. And I'm not excusing sins within those various forces aforementioned, necessarily. I mean, I would have to take it on a case-by-case basis. But it seems like, you know, we don't want to fall into the agenda of, well, we have to remove President Bush. We have to impeach him. Oh, he's evil. He lied to us. I mean, it's possible that there's more to this. It's possible that that's the case, but it is also possible that it isn't the case, and that he's being removed because he's too Christian for the real dark forces behind the scenes, even if he is compromised.
Well, it's interesting to see how the news media frames the country's conscience. The country's conscience needs to be prompted. In the Nixon era, of course, there was this giant, he did what? I mean, the news media was aghast that a president would lie and cover up and so on. And here, you know, they're just trying to get out of it by saying, well, basically, it was a mistake. We used false information. We admit it's false. We don't admit we lied. Now, the public doesn't seem to have any outrage on this because it's the way it's framed, and the news media doesn't seem to go along with any kind of outrage at all. So this is what's happening here. In fact, as I say, so far this evening, 9:37 Pacific time, we don't have any outrage being expressed in the news media yet. It might be on some other form of the news wires, but I don't see it yet. So,
but you know, there's some people, Bill, who say, look, it doesn't really matter whether the weapons of mass destruction. We needed to get our troops over there because only then, of course, we're going to be able to, have a military presence there and stop the further funding of the Islamic terrorists who threaten us. And so, well, maybe they had to use that as an excuse. But of course, now we can get over there, our troops there, or we can, put pressure on Iran. Maybe we can bring pressure on Saudi Arabia. Either you stop funding the terrorists, or we're going to, of course, take military action or destabilize your government. And so, really, this was a great act of patriotism. It's sort of like Pearl Harbor, you know. Yes, certainly, we knew the attack was coming. We left those boys there to die. But look at the greater good. We were able to stop the Japanese. We certainly were able to stop Adolf Hitler before he invaded New York. So that was justified. There are a lot of people who look back at that era and, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor and justified the fact that the president knew what was happening and lied to the people because it was for a greater good. And it may very well be that this approach, and I've even read this in a number of articles, sort of saying, well, it doesn't really matter whether we're any weapons of mass destruction. We had to have an excuse to go in, but look how much better it is now that we have our troops there and we can begin to dominate that area, which is funding the terrorists that threaten us. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think if you have just cause, you don't need to lie.
Of course not.
Of course not. And people are dying. Our sons and our daughters are there now. So, you know, people need to know what their valor is really all about. There needs to be some reality. If you just lie about it, Well, then how can you, I guess, is there a lie with a just cause behind it, or a lie with an evil cause behind it? I don't know what the difference is, and if you can't have the truth, then I don't know how you can really say you're going to send your boys to war. So it becomes very difficult. Of course, we have historically pointed out, I think, on your radio show, that none of the modern wars, the Spanish-American War, was a falsehood as far as its trigger, because we found out that we went down and looked at that USS Maine in Havana Harbor and found out that the boiler room in the ship blew up. The Spanish didn't blow it up. It was an accident, and this triggered the war mistakenly used to trigger the Spanish-American War. World War One, of course, was the Lusitania. It was sunk. It made it look like the Germans used a submarine to sink an innocent boat filled with innocent tourists and so on, when the boat was filled with munitions. Now, we didn't tell our people that. If a boat filled with munitions was approaching the U.S. coast, would we sink it? We might. So, you see, it just is all how it sounds. So, of course, we know Pearl Harbor, World War II. In fact, I have the article right here on my desk because I was just reading it as to who fired the first shots at Pearl Harbor. Turns out we did. The U.S. Sunk a Japanese submarine about an hour and a half before any of those planes came over. We fired the first shots and sunk the submarine. We detected it and sunk it. So none of it was a surprise as we say it was. And, of course, you can look into all those facts yourself. And now we admit the Gulf of Tonkin, an event that triggered the war, of course, in Southeast Asia, Vietnam. Of course, that was a contrived event. It never occurred. So these kind of triggering events, we have to wonder, they're all contrived, and of course our sons and daughters go off to war with them. If we have a just cause, what do we need them for?
Let me ask you this question. Do you deny, though, that the forces I mentioned, President Bush, Israel, the Chinese, the Muslims, the Vatican also, those primarily are forces slated by the globalist agenda, by the Illuminati, whatever you want to call them, that they're forces slated to go, and that we have to be careful of falling into any kind of manipulation. Oh, it's Bush. Well, sure, Bush, the Bush family is obviously part and parcel of this whole thing, but I don't know that they're at the highest level of it, and frankly, I want to approach this on a factual basis. I don't want to necessarily be manipulated, just as the nation has sometimes been manipulated against leaders before.
Well, let me tell you what I think, Nathan. I think that there is an organized effort to play the Christians against the Jews and the Christians and Jews against the Muslims, and to use them to destroy one another. Because if you read the writings of the elite, and you'll find that in the Global Biodiversity Assessment published by Cambridge University Press and summarized in our Sustainable Development Syllabus, they say that, of course, the Muslim, the Jewish, and the Christian religions are really behind everything wrong in the world today. And, of course, they're going to have to be eliminated. They make that statement, in essence, exactly what they say. And you can see how now, of course, we're building up hatred for the Muslims, and, of course, we're building up Muslim hatred for the Christians and the Jews, and we're all being manipulated. It's about time we realized it. Hey, look, thanks.
Well, Satan despises those three religions primarily, you know?
He sure does. Okay.
Especially
the Jews. If he can destroy the Jews, of course, he thinks he's thwarted God's plan. And unless we look at this from a spiritual point of view, we're going to get the wrong answer.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Nathan. Bye-bye. And, of course, we've got Mike calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Stan. Actually, it's fundamentalism in general. Anybody who has a religious conviction that they'll carry into their life or their politics or whatever, those people become suspect.
Okay, but of course, I'm specifically quoting the Global Biodiversity Assessment,
and
they specifically name the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews as unsustainable religions.
Yeah, and so we have presidents who are portrayed as Christians, and so the whole country can turn against them and turn against Christianity, and turns into a quagmire.
Right, and so we've just got to we've got to be able to keep our heads while everybody else is losing theirs.
Yeah. Anyhow, for the record, we had a big article on all this regarding Bush and the intelligence about the nuclear material in Iraq and everything in yesterday's paper. an AP article in our humble, actually pathetic, little local paper, the Sentinel. Very interesting. It focuses on Joseph Wilson, the former U.S. ambassador to Gabon, who was backed by the CIA to investigate these allegations about the Iraq's nuclear weapons program. Interestingly, this article makes the UN look shiny, saying that the UN determined that uranium reports were based mostly on forged documents about a month before Bush's speech. So anyhow, it's out here. It's okay. Out here in the news.
Okay.
Yeah, that part has been out in the news, and on this side of the ocean, the new part is Bush is admitting this was a mistake. It was in his, of course, his State of the Union address. But and you know, and then but the big part is that they're admitting that the CIA has released information to BBC News that this was all known prior and known to be false. So, you know, this looks pretty bad.
Bill, the thing that bothers me is why would the CIA, which is supposedly subservient to the president, be releasing information to BBC News to destroy the career of Tony Blair and, of course, undermine our own president? What's wrong with this scenario?
It may have something to do with one of the former directors of the CIA.
George, who are you thinking
of? H.W.
Oh, you mean George? You mean George Herbert Walker Bush would not be trying to discredit his son, Mike?
Well, no.
All right, fine. Anything else you want to say?
That's all.
All right, thank you. But I think you raise a very, very significant point. We can only speculate. What now? First of all, the CIA never leaks any information or makes a statement without a specific purpose or goal in mind. It's sort of like the leak that they put out about West Nile virus when it struck in 1999, and they of course leaked that to a man named Richard Preston that they thought Saddam Hussein had released a West Nile virus. And I simply asked the question, did Saddam Hussein really attack us with West Nile virus in 1999? Was the CIA covering up the fact that it's been working with covert biological warfare ever since then? Then the same thing would be true if they released this story to the British media. They did it for a specific and calculated purpose. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree. And, of course, writers out of Britain reporting, we have found a country that was, of course, conducting tests on weapons of mass destruction in 1962 to 1971 during that period. And, of course, it was onshore here in the United States, our own government testing sarin gas and VX nerve agents, and now they admit it was done onshore. Now, governments like ours are likely to do these things covertly. They're likely to do them somewhere else. It's surprising they were doing them on shore here. So, we're playing with these things, and we're playing with a lot of things that all of a sudden emanate into diseases. So you've got to wonder where they're coming from Saddam Hussein's or from our own laboratories. That's what happened, apparently, in the anthrax outbreak, because they tracked it down genetically to, of course, the U.S. Army Weapons Lab in Maryland. So how did it get out of there? Who is the one who followed it? It's interesting that George Bush is traveling around the globe without a concern in his mind as to who the anthrax terrorist was. He's still out here somewhere, and we don't seem to be doing much. We don't seem to, the yellow alerts go up every day over something somewhere, but it's never about the anthrax terrorists.
Well, you know, of course, the whole story of the anthrax, there's one thing that nobody ever wants to mention. That was something you drew to my attention, and we had it verified from many sources, and that is on the evening of September 11th, 2001, the evening of the attack on the World Trade Center, Dick Cheney, the vice president, and his entire staff went on to CIPRO. Now, why would they start CIPRO on the day of a aircraft attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? The only reason to start CIPRO, which is not an innocuous medication, because it can actually attack your collagen tissue and you'll end up with a ruptured Achilles tendon or other major tendon ruptures. The only reason to do that is if you had been exposed to anthrax, or you knew an anthrax attack was coming, or you suspected an anthrax was coming. Absolutely no other reason to start on a course of CIPRO. And if they thought an anthrax attack was coming, if they knew it was coming, or even if they suspected it was coming, why didn't they tell the American people? And I think that's the question nobody wants to ask, because the answer, of course, is rather frightening in its implications.
Well, I think the next time that events as big as 9/11 occur, people need to be very alert, need to write things down, need to get out their tape recorders and start taping events on television so they can recall and remember and see the sequence of things. I mean, I recall on the very evening I was in New York on the day of 9/11, and I could recall being at someone's house and watching CNN, and all of a sudden CNN departed from the news, of course, there at the World Trade Center towers and so on, to take us to Kabul, Afghanistan, where there had been some sort of an overthrow of some sort of an insurgent chief there. But wait a minute, how was the CNN connecting 9/11 to Afghanistan? We didn't even know who was on the plane jets. We didn't know they were Arabs or who they were. And of course, all of a sudden, CNN seemed to have some advanced knowledge and was making the public aware of a link that maybe we needed to go and fight a war against the terrorists who might have been from Afghanistan. How would they know? We had no knowledge at the time. It was the whole events of 9/11 were fresh from that morning, and so it was impossible to see how CNN, of course, had planted that information, and the public looked at it and didn't put two and two together. So you'd have seen the lie right there. So.
Well, Chris, there's a fascinating article in Insight magazine, the last one that came out. It has a girl on the cover with, of course, pictures of the flag on both cheeks and her forehead. If you want to know which one it is, or if you don't have the Insight, I would be glad to send you the article. But it's talking about how within 2 days of the attack, we knew who all of the people were, at least we said we did. And how did we know who the 19 hijackers were? Well, because of their passports and because of the manifestos for the planes. But if you read the list, none of their names are on the flight manifesto. I mean, I've checked the flight manifestos up on the web, and none of the Arab names are there. But they mentioned the passports. And of course, how do they know what their passports showed? Well, of course, two of them were recovered. One was recovered in New York, and one was recovered in Pennsylvania. And so since the passports were there, that must have been who the people were. One of them was thrown out of the airplane before it crashed and fluttered to the ground about a block away from the World Trade Center. The other was found adjacent to the crash site in Pennsylvania. I think there that they rolled down the window of the airplane before they crashed. And nobody, of course, asks how, when you're having these flaming infernos, do these passports survive? Unless, of course, that is planted evidence. It's sort of like the stockings of O.J. Simpson. They were, of course, soaked with the blood of Nicole. The only trouble was on the stocking, it was both sides of the stocking, exactly. In other words, the stocking had been taken off and the blood had been poured out. Both sides of the stocking were involved. And it had a preservative in it, the sort that you'd use if you'd taken a blood specimen from Nicole and then poured the blood onto O.J. Simpson's sock. Now, I don't know whether O.J. Simpson was guilty or innocent, but of course the people who watched the trial said whether he was guilty or innocent, he was framed, and a lot of people think they framed a guilty man. And of course, that's exactly what was going on here at 9/11. How did those passports get? Nobody has ever asked yet why those passports survived. Why, of course, these Arab terrorists are getting on a suicide mission, take a pack, a suitcase, and then leave it in the car where it'll be found with all of the Islamic paraphernalia in it, talking about the plans for the attack. Or why six of the people are still alive, and that's what the article, of course, in Insight magazine is all about. Six of the people whose pictures are shown are alive and well in Saudi Arabia or in Arabia. What's wrong with this picture? Well, maybe they're not telling us the truth. How could within 2 hours of the attack they knew exactly who many of these people were, because they were at their homes, the restaurants where they ate, the neighborhoods where they lived, and certainly at the flight schools where they trained, within 2 hours of the attack? If you want the documentation, it's in Kristen Breitner's testimony before the Senate Investigating Committee, House Senate Investigating Committee. It's up on my website in the October newsletter, and we can get you the originals. How within 2 hours, if they had no idea an attack was coming, how did those passports get there? All these questions and nobody wants to ask.
Well, what was the military doing with an AWACS airplane? This is an airplane used by the military that can monitor every airplane in the sky. It was up in the air in that area of Washington, D.C., Pennsylvania. What was it doing? What command did it have? And, of course, they could then see all the planes in action at that time. How could they make the claim that they weren't able to respond in time? They actually had an airborne AWACS plane in command and working in that zone at the very time all those events occurred. Of course, they don't admit that. It came out later here in a report by a wise reporter who happened to see the plane in the air and did ask the military if it was up in the air. They did admit it, that it was in an obscure report from a reporter in Pennsylvania. So it was in the air. They were doing something, and, of course, we never hear what they were doing or have any accountability on that day for that plane. So there are just so many things that don't make any sense, of course.
And, of course, I think the most incredible story was, I mean, Andrews Air Force Base is 2 minutes from Washington, D.C., and, of course, here there's a plane heading towards Washington, D.C. It's the third plane. They've already crashed planes into the North Tower, into the South Tower. There's a plane heading towards Washington, D.C. You know, and obviously it's a suicide plane. It's the third plane, third of the four planes that have been hijacked. So what do? They've got planes there on full military alert at Andrews Air Force Base. Do they send them to guard Washington, D.C.? No. They bring in planes from Cape Cod at subsonic speeds that arrive 12 minutes after the plane is flown a loop around Washington, D.C., and then cars come in and hit the Pentagon. So flying loops around Washington, D.C., 2 minutes away, of course, there are fighter planes, and they bring them in from Cape Cod, and nobody wants to ask the very logical questions. Was there prior knowledge, and who gave the orders not to mobilize the planes from Andrews Air Force Base, but bring them in at subsonic speeds? Because they would have had to have almost stopped off for breakfast going as slowly as they did getting to Washington, D.C. And, of course, 3,000 Americans died. And, of course, the investigation that they have now is not to find or to reveal what went on, but to conceal it. And where is the outrage from the American people? And, of course, it's deafening in its silence. We're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight, Bill?
Keep looking. Wait for the next big event when it occurs. Remember, tape everything, write everything down, keep the newspapers for a few days. You'll see the inconsistencies yourself. Check on the news media. Remember, they're sometimes pawns in the game. Sometimes they're active players in the game. And, of course, sometimes these things are all scripted. From our side, look, you're trying to get a populace to go to war. Obviously, the news media, you can see it here from Fox News on down, cooperated with the United States government. Of course, we have to protect our troops. We have to do things for our side. But understand, much of the motion of this went into effect long before we went to war. CNN, of course, had they ran a whole documentary, you know, how the women were being mistreated in Afghanistan, softening us up for the war there. So all of these things, propaganda, and we need to understand the difference between propaganda and news.
Howard, what's your website?
Website, askbillsardi.com. Come visit. It's all free information about health care, anything you need right there, askbillsardi.com.
All right, and fine. And then what's the website to get your books?
Books, hearnowbooks.com, and of course we invite you there. Anybody who likes to read good health books on vitamins, nutrition, and of course we do have so many wonderful things to talk about. I think we're out of time here.
We get all wound up on these other things, but we'll talk again.
Okay.
So thanks so much, Bill.
You're
thanks back. For being with us. And
okay.
Of course, this is the time when I ask our listeners to pray for America, to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you.